Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Author J.J. Gold has been an athlete, musician, restaurant owner, and world traveler. He grew up in New York City and now lives in Grass Valley, California, where he works with seekers of truth, assisting them in their search for meaning. He has been an unlicensed, unaccredited spiritual friend, teacher, guide, master, and guru to hundreds of people, and has written four books. The title of his latest book comes from a childhood nickname, Justin Time. He says this book contains autobiographical stories from an American spiritual master. J.J. Gold, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Now, you give some advice in your book about how we as readers should read your book. And you tell this, you give us this advice at the end of a story about a childhood friend. And what advice do you have when we pick up your book to read it? How should we read it?
Well, there's the line in a song called Take What You Can and Leave the Rest. It's a song that has some meaning for me, and I found that useful advice because there is so much potential for disagreement. But if we can take the benefits that we can get and leave the disagreements behind, we can get a lot more. So that's the advice that I give.
Well, I found that actually true because I opened it up and you have some things to say about an eclipse. And I thought, well, Justin, I don't know if I agree with that or not, what you have to say about an eclipse. But then I turn the next page and I say, wow, he's right on. That reflects my experience. So I found that to be true. And you say, well, if something doesn't seem to jibe with your observation of the world, just keep reading and you'll come across something that will.
Well, hopefully, eventually, you will come across something you will, but if you don't, you can always put it down. But there are a few controversial ideas in the book, and it really wouldn't be a meaningful book if there weren't some controversial ideas in there. So I have not shied away from putting those controversial ideas in the book, and one of them being that an eclipse is a point of view. It would be a strange thing to consider that the universe has conspired to give us a particular angle on the sun and the moon rather than we happen to be sitting in a particular place or traveling to a particular place.
Well, when I mentioned what you say in your book about the fact that, well, the sun and the moon, it doesn't affect them. They're just doing what they do naturally. And we label it as something special, an eclipse. And I was telling this to a friend of eclipses. And he said, well, but the animals react to what goes on during an eclipse, that it really does have an impact.
Uh-huh. Well, I imagine it does from their point of view, although I'm not privy to the subtleties of the animals' point of view. But I know for human beings, we frequently consider events significant when the events themselves are not significant, but our participation in them is significant. And I think it's important for those two ideas and points of view to be separated. What really is historical and what circulates around us as individuals.
Well, you also state in your book, after you're telling this story, you say, I'm telling this story and evoking this feeling in myself in hopes that you might remember some situation in your own life when you had this particular experience. And I really remembered that sentence, Justin, because it was very true. So many of your stories did cause me to remember situations in my own life. I would stop and go to my bookshelf and look at a book that I hadn't looked at in a while, or go through my files and pull out something that I hadn't looked at in a while. So as far as I'm concerned, you succeeded in helping me remember situations in my own life.
Well, I hope you found that to be useful. We have a phenomenal number of common denominators as human beings, but mostly we're asked and almost demanded to refer to ourselves in terms of our separateness and how we're different and how we're different, whether it be ethnicity or religion or ideas or education. But we do have something actually to be proud of, and that is being a human being. And we really have lost that pride in dividing our prides into prides that we have, things that we've accomplished or things about us that are different than other people, rather than to recognize our common unity as human beings, which is something bona fide to be proud of.
My guest is J.J. Gold. That's the name he writes under, Justin Gold. And his book is Just in Time, Autobiographical Stories from an American Spiritual Master. And I might mention that this Just in Time, Justin is written as one word. And you might tell us how that came about, this title, Just in Time.
Well, when I was a kid, it was a teasing phrase that I was just in time. It was before the time that Justins were proliferated, or that name was proliferated.
It's a very popular name now.
Very, very
popular name. To name young boys
name.
Justin.
Yes, and I said in the book, every time I hear the name, I look around to see if I've been called, because for years I was being called because I was the Justin, and there were very few other Justins. So I took that name, Just in Time, but I used as my name on my books, J.J. Gold, and the reason that I use J.J. Gold instead of Justin Gold, which is my name, is because when you Google Justin Gold, you get the Peanut Butter King. there are so many entries to the Peanut Butter King. Although I respect his business ability, I didn't want us to be confused. So I changed it to J as an initial J, and my middle name, which is a family name with an E on the end, is unique. So that's the name I use.
So I mentioned that the first is an initial J, and then spelled out J-A-Y-E, and then Gold.
Yes.
J.J. Gold. Well, you mentioned when you were growing up, and you grew up in New York City. I grew up in the Deep South, so I couldn't identify with your growing up in New York City. I mean, I visited the city, but to me, those experiences were outside my own experiences growing up. But so much of your life, I did have similar experiences. Even the story you tell when you were an 18-year-old and you happen to know Peter Falk. And when I read your story, I thought, oh my gosh, I remember something similar in my life. But first, tell us, what happened when you knew Peter Falk?
Well, we crossed paths in a pool room. He was actor at the time, really more of an aspiring actor. He wasn't yet in Columbo, but he was an accomplished actor. And the Broadway area where a lot of actors spend their time was near this particular pool room. And I was quite young, maybe 18 or 19, and I was trying to figure out where I fit in New York City. I'd grown up more in the suburbs than in the Bronx, but down in Manhattan was a much more sophisticated and high-pressure place, and I was trying to find my way there. And so I crossed paths with him, and we became pool-playing buddies. And one time he was going to an interview, to an audition. I don't think he was auditioning. He was not auditioning, but it was some friends were producing a play. He asked me to come along, take a walk. And so we took a walk, and then we sat in the theater, and while the reading was going on, he poked me and said, "Hey, why don't you go up? You would be great in this part." And I laughed, thought he was joking, but he poked me again after a few minutes and said, "Yeah, go up there, do it." And I said, "Okay." And
So you go up with nothing to lose?
Basically, I had nothing to lose except whatever pride I had, but it would be doubtful that I would see anybody who I was seeing. So I did go up. He arranged it. I went up, and I gave it everything. I really was shouting and screaming and like that. And my concept was something like James Dean or Marlon Brando. So I just acted out, and the producer wanted to give me the part. It was a small part, but he wanted to give me a part. But I had a very strong hunch at that point that I was at a cusp, and that if I would go along with this, something that I had no interest whatsoever and no gravitation toward being, that it would design the next phase of my life. So I actually described in the book the story that I ran out of the theater, which I did.
Because he wanted to cast you.
Yes. Uh-huh.
He gave you the part, and you declined.
I declined, and I'm glad to this day that I did.
And yet, it was a successful play you turned down.
It was an off-Broadway play down in Greenwich Village, and it became successful, yes.
And with an actor that we've all heard of.
Yes, Dustin Hoffman.
Dustin Hoffman,
yes,
was in that, and yes, you turned down a play. You could have been with Dustin Hoffman.
That's true.
Well, I wonder if, well, you said it wasn't something that really interested you, because you're, in your book, you encourage us not to turn down adventures. You encourage us to be adventurous, but that just wasn't a direction you wanted to go.
Well, the adventure I was currently participating or engulfed in, you might say, was becoming a New York City gambler and promoter, and that was a world that was curious to me from both the movies and people that I had run into from time to time. And I was curious to see. I knew I was bright, but I didn't know if I had the qualifications. And I was in the midst of seeing if I could become part of that world.
Well, when I read your story, it caused me to rethink a situation that I found myself in a few years ago. There was this young screenwriter. He'd written this screenplay, but he was unknown. And he asked me to audition for this first movie. And I thought, oh, I have to go down to L.A., and I don't think I'll bother. This was Alexander Payne. And I still have the script that he sent me. How was I to know he was going to end up winning Academy Awards and working with Jack Nicholson and George Clooney? And I thought, gosh, what did I miss by turning down that opportunity? And then when I read what you had written, I thought, well, maybe that's not a direction I really would have wanted to go. So you kind of made me feel a little better about passing up that opportunity.
Uh-huh. Well, it's not a direction that has led to a lot of satisfaction for people. More like the opposite. Although in the American story, it's put forth as a dream life, as something to really aspire to. But if we would more closely examine people not only in show business, but people of extreme affluence in all walks of life, that our concept of the control leading, of their control through having money and influence leading to satisfaction and happiness and any kind of peace really doesn't verify itself according to the facts.
My guest is Grass Valley author. He lives in Grass Valley now. We've been talking about his growing up in New York City. He writes under the name J.J. Gold. And his fourth book is Just in Time, Autobiographical Stories from an American Spiritual Master. And when you call yourself, are you the one calling yourself an American Spiritual Master, Justin?
I am.
Now, do you think that's kind of cheeky?
It would be if it were not accurate. But I'm no longer young, and I've been in this position for 35 years, and you might say, assigned to do this kind of work. It wasn't my idea at the time. In fact, it was very much not my idea at the time, even after the training that I had, which was considerable. My concept was that after all this training, I would be going off by myself somewhere and being more secluded and isolated. But then I was told to go and put up a poster and get people to come by and see if I could pass on anything that I understood to them. And I've been doing that for a long time. And it's really not for a flower to say how well it smells. So, but people who talk to my friends and my students and people I've had influence on seem to corroborate this hypothesis.
Well, one thing that lends credibility to what you've just said is the fact that you didn't set yourself up as some guru who's going to be charging people and trying to make money out of this deal. In fact, you don't charge people who seek your wisdom, if I want to call it that.
Yeah. Well, I have maybe a unique idea about where it's appropriate to involve money, because I certainly have nothing against commerce whatsoever. I think that commerce is most harmoniously involved when the person who's buying knows what they're buying. And in this instance, a person could not possibly know. I mean, I might entitle a book autobiography, Stories of an American Spiritual Master, but there's no way a person can know that. They can say he thinks that, he says that, but it might take years for that person to understand that. And for those years, that person is exploring, and a person exploring shouldn't be charged to explore, in my view. So I have not involved money or commerce in any phase whatsoever of this. In fact, if anybody ever wants any of my books and they can't afford it, I've said numerous times, email me and I'll send you one.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. After a break, I'll continue my conversation with spiritual master J.J. Gold. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is J.J. Gold, and he has written a book, Just in Time, Autobiographical Stories from an American Spiritual Master. Well, I also might mention that in the 1980s, you founded a nonprofit organization that continues to do service projects in the United States and abroad. So this from somebody who started out as a... Well, how would you describe yourself as a kid in New York City? You manipulative, maybe,
yes,
is an adjective?
That would be kind. yes, definitely a promoter and someone who is looking to get the best side of things, and frequently with the other person, let's not call him a victim, but the other person getting the worst side of things, you know, through gambling and promoting. And
yeah, you were a gambler. And,
yes.
You were a boxer.
Yes. Uh-huh.
That
yeah.
seems an inauspicious start for a spiritual master, Justin.
It does, but in retrospect, it's very clear to me that all the doors that I walked through made my capacity to not only relate to people, but to know the different steps of the American experience. Certainly, I wouldn't presume to be able to assist someone who was from another culture. But in terms of the American experience, I feel very familiar. What you're mentioning about doing the social work projects and the organization that we founded, if I can say a couple of words about that.
Please do.
It became obvious to me, not so much from my idea, but one of my students' ideas, that we should reach out in that way because of our fortunateness and see if we could incorporate that in our school and our learning. And we started doing that about 20 years ago in Thailand. And it was so not only such a rich experience for us, but helpful to the people that we worked with, and since then have taken trips and spent extensive periods of time in Thailand and Cambodia, and Hurricane Katrina after that crisis, and Syrian refugees on the Turkish border most recently, doing whatever we could.
You're mentioning all these somewhat exotic places, and I was impressed by how much traveling you have done, because I've lived in a third world country too. I've not been to Afghanistan, but you spent a good bit of time in places like Afghanistan.
Well, I made probably four trips to Afghanistan, and the total time probably would add up to about 6 months that I've spent there. I spent a little more time in South America, in Peru, probably total of 2 or 3 years. Other trips than that have been more like a few weeks, a few months here and there.
Well, I think people reading your book was saying, gosh, he's had so many various adventures. How did he have time for all these careers as an athlete, a musician, gambler, boxer? How did he have time for this? Well, you have lived a rather long life, so you have had a chance to have all these various experiences, starting with a musician at a very young age. You played violin.
Yes. That was something that was inflicted upon me. And I was 3 years old when I started, and my violin was about as big as two hands worth. But I did play and was very popular at my family gatherings and would hide in my bedroom because I knew the call would go, Dusty, which was my nickname at the time, Dusty, come and play, Dusty, come and play. And I would, from time to time, come out and play, but usually pretend I didn't hear. Then I discovered fun in music was really playing other instruments with the advent of Elvis and rock and roll. And it became harder and harder for me to maintain the violin dedication.
Well, you had all these various experiences, and you tell us in this book that all these experiences, we should accept, not try to change what comes our way, because that's what we need for learning.
It's really not necessary to create artificial situations. It's not really necessary to fabricate conditions. Because as life comes to us, if we don't avoid what crosses our path, there's tremendous opportunities. But unfortunately, life has become a challenge in how to avoid what's unpleasant. And the person who's considered successful in life is the person that's been able to gain the financial stability and control so that they can avoid both the people contacts and the circumstance contacts that could conceivably make them a fuller people, but it doesn't happen.
My guest is Grass Valley author J.J. Gold. His fourth book that has just come out, Just in Time, Autobiographical Stories from an American Spiritual Master. And you have these American experiences. You didn't just sit on some mountaintop in the Himalayas and have no basis, no common ground with those of us who are living normal lives here in the United States.
Yes, I did put in my time, mountaintop time.
And in fact, an example of something that circumstances that presented themselves that you probably would have been tempted to resist was you're getting ready to fly out of India back to the United States, and your flight gets delayed and you can't get on the plane, and yet you had this rather amazing experience due to the fact that you couldn't fly back when you thought you needed to.
Yes, very true. A significant, you might say, watershed cusp experience from the end of my life, because at that time, my concept of the spiritual pursuit and really any pursuit of excellence circulated around intellectual capacity, ability, wisdom, knowledge, and I was not really sensitive to the heart component and the sweetness that was below the surface. It was not really part of my upbringing. I was more either intellectual or cynical or tough. And these really very fortunate random circumstances of getting or fortuitous experience of getting my plane canceled and being stuck in an ashram with people who were very different and had very different valuation systems than I had. And after a while, they got through to me.
Because you say they were very sweet, and they just said, okay, Justin, open up your heart.
Yes, and give up your mind. That was the challenge.
And when I was reading this story of your experience in the ashram, I thought of my favorite, he's deceased now, guru, and his phrase, he didn't speak much English. He would say, do the practice and all is coming. In other words, let's not just sit here talking about it. Just do the practice and you will get the answers to your questions. Less talking and just opening up to the practice. And I thought of that when you were, and these young women were just so nice to you, and you came around to their way of thinking eventually.
Yes.
Or not thinking.
Exactly. Well said.
So what did they encourage you to do or not do?
Well, there were nightly meetings with singing and very devotional scene.
That was the practice, like the guru that I liked was saying, do these things like you're just saying. So you get together and you do this devotional singing and what else?
And there was meditation was involved, which I already was doing and I had evaluation for, but theirs was more expressive, and certainly their interactions were more affectionate and sweet. And they, at some point, they said to me, "Hey, I know you're having a hard time, but there's this one guy who comes from the U.S. and he's here, and you really could talk to him. Maybe he'll be able to help you out." And so I said, "Okay, great. I'm going to be able to talk to him." And I went to find him, and within 10 seconds of our conversation, he said, "Just give up your mind." I knew I was sunk at that point.
My guest is J.J. Gold, and he is telling us some of the stories that of his life as an American spiritual master. And I mentioned the fact that you started out with, I would say it's not that atypical when you were growing up in New York for a kid to have the kind of life that you had.
Definitely unusual and not really attractive to me at the time, although it does fuel stories that I can tell. But my family, one generation removed, came from Eastern Europe and ended up moving as a unit, a large unit, to Manhattan and then to the Bronx. And so we had a rather large family with all the grandparents, both grandparents, and a lot of people living in that very large apartment. We were relatively affluent, so it wasn't a poverty situation. But there was always a lot of people, and two of my grandparents who still had a valuation for helping people who were immigrants involved in settling people when they came to this country.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. After a break, I'll continue my conversation with author J.J. Gold, who lives in Grass Valley. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. My guest is spiritual master J.J. Gold, and he has written a book he calls Just in Time. He says it contains autobiographical stories from an American spiritual master. you were saying that when you were growing up with this varied cultural, ethnic group that you were exposed to, but also various religions. So you weren't asked to be strict about one particular religion.
Well, by each contingency, I was asked to be strict about it. there was a lottery, and I was the prize of the lottery, my sister and myself, and where in which direction we would go. But it certainly was unique that I had, in my very young years, opportunities to go to Eastern Orthodox churches and mosques and Hebrew synagogues. I went to all of them and wasn't particularly interested in any of them, but I certainly had that religious and ethnic, let's say, acceptance to that there were people who of all different kinds that lived together, because we did live together. I was unfortunately embarrassed about the situation more than anything else, and was reluctant.
Well, kids are, you know, they're embarrassed by their parents, and you had this unusual situation. So, I think it's understandable that was understandable reaction as a young person to the fact that, gosh, here's this house full of people.
Yeah.
It's not like my friend,
and not a lot of English spoken as well.
Well, you also described that as you were going to these various houses of worship, you didn't really see kind of the point of some of that, and you'd have to learn to speak in a language you didn't even understand, and there was all this ritual, but you came around to appreciating ritual.
I did, but it certainly took a while, and it had to be ritual that I understood not only how to perform the ritual, but what the value was and what the essence was behind the ritual, because so many things that are performed now, and I tell a story about some monks that I observed in Japan just a couple of years ago, and who had a very detailed and extensive ritual in their candle putting on, lighting and putting out. And I don't know if these monks understood the essence or the background of the ritual, or they just performed it perfectly. But the idea of doing something because somebody else does it and you're shown without having some understanding of where it comes from, where it's going, like that, didn't seem of value to me and still doesn't. So whatever teaching or assisting I do is based on verification. And I've never asked anybody to trust me or distrust me. There's really no reason to trust me or distrust me. It's try it and verify for yourself if there's some value there to you.
In fact, I appreciate that. Not saying do this because I say so. Don't just believe me, but try it, and anything you decide or you believe is because of your own experience and not because I say so. And I appreciated that about your message. You also in your book say there's a time in your life when it comes time to let go of things. And when I was reading this section of your book, I was thinking about sometimes open my closet, think, I need more clothes hangers. And then I catch myself and say, no, I need to give away some clothes. Then I'll have plenty of clothes hangers. And this is kind of what you're saying, I think, when you say that you have to release some of what you've been doing to let go and move on in your life. How did you describe that?
Well, I see that something that we have failed to understand in the West is that life does come to us in phases. And the phase of life and the appropriate behavior and exploration necessary for a young person may be very different than for a person who's had a lot of life experience. So my advice to young people is be bold, take chances, go out and do things, and explore and see what calls out to you. But after you've done that and you've gone through the repetitions that will lead you to, it may be that something else is calling out to you. And I do see that that change in phase is really important. And similar to what you're describing, there is a phase of life for accumulating things. And a person should not be discouraged from accumulating things. Some things attractive to them, whether they're experiences or goods or people. But at some point, a person might feel the repetitious element of that accumulation. And at that point, it might be more appropriate to start relinquishing rather than acquiring. Yes.
Uh-huh. In fact, one of my favorite quotes from Thoreau is that things are much more easily acquired than gotten rid of. And he was writing back quite some years ago. I thought it was interesting that you're making this point after talking about playing poker. And you come to the point in this chapter when you say, I don't think we have to refer to poker anymore because the strength of being able to leave something behind, to be able to release when you recognize that something is not going to live up to your hopes, is an asset in far more than a card game. And you can say that can happen with a talent, it can happen with a relationship, it can happen with a place where you live, it can happen with an occupation. And you say, yeah, it's challenging to release. But you conclude this chapter by saying, maybe it's time to release. Maybe you're on the cusp of a new phase of life, and the command to release is bubbling up from within you. Your past challenges of how to resolve problems, plans, and relationships may be in the process of being replaced by the challenge to discriminate between what needs to be held on to and what needs to be released.
Good writing.
Isn't that wonderful writing? And it's also very wise. Uh-huh. Because people my age and even younger are facing retirement, and I've known, for example, some years ago, a doctor, when he retired, he couldn't let go of the fact that he had been a doctor. And you'd practically ask him any question, and he would reply with, well, I was a doctor. No matter what the question, what's your favorite color? Well, I was a doctor. And a lot of people, when they're facing that, can I really let go? Can I really retire? Who would I be if I'm no longer what I was? And so you encourage us, though. You say, maybe it's time to release, to let go.
Mm-hmm. I had some experience of that in a really simple way. The first time that I went to Florida, which is a relatively popular place to go.
For young people?
For young people from New York, from the Northeast, to go there during Christmas or during the spring break. And I did it, maybe even drove by Georgia where you
were growing up.
Yeah, I remember going down that road all the way down through Florida to South Florida. And the first time I went, I couldn't conceive of what the heat and what that would be like. I didn't have any idea, so I brought, along with bathing suits and clothes of that kind, I brought a down jacket. And thinking, well, I always use a down jacket. And so I had the down jacket with me for about a week when people said, why do you keep carrying that around? Why do you keep carrying it around? It was time to leave it behind, at least in the motel room.
My guest is J.J. Gold, and his book is entitled Just in Time, Autobiographical Stories from an American Spiritual Master. So you mentioned this in your chapter about, you're talking about poker, but you're saying here's a lesson that applies not just to poker. And you also hinted about the fact that you can have adventures, and some of us don't realize that maybe we're turning down opportunities and choosing safety over adventure. And my husband's deceased now, but I realized at some point I had married Indiana Jones. I thought, like, my best friend grew up, married a doctor, and they had the station wagon, the two kids, and the typical life. And I married Indiana Jones, and off we went to live in Peru. And at one point, we'd been living in California, and we decided we'd go live in Charleston, South Carolina for a year. And people said, why are you doing that? And my husband replied, for the adventure. And boy, was it ever. That, I even started writing a book on that one year in Charleston that involved a hurricane, a trial with F. Lee Bailey as one of the attorneys. And I thought, boy, yeah, that was an adventure. I wouldn't have wanted to miss that. So now sometimes when an opportunity comes along and I think, oh my gosh, am I up for that? And then I think about what you have written about we're end up following some other road in the quest for safety rather than adventure.
Well, it's certainly attractive to be around the what's known to us, unfortunately, what happens is the science of making everything known is the science that we study and the science that we lead and that we pursue, not really understanding what the downside is to that, how much is lost for that. But if you're very fortunate in the story that you're telling with that you ran into this person who was adventurous. But so many people don't, and they go along and take the safe way or the known way or the comfortable way, because comfortable is a very, very popular word. You know, when you walk into a different place, people ask, are you comfortable? Are you comfortable? When very frequently, comfort is not the most attractive experience to us. Anybody who's experienced an adventure knows that comfort is rarely part and parcel of that adventure.
I think if you're too comfortable, you never make the changes. You never make that step that your life could be even better. And often when I'd be living in a place and my husband would say, okay, time to leave now and go do this next adventure. I'd say, oh, but I never went whitewater rafting and I didn't do this. And then I learned you got to do it when the chance is there. And then when we would move, I thought, boy, this is even better than I could have imagined. And I love the conclusion of this chapter, these stories you're telling, on page 118. Would you mind, Justin, would you read that? This is this after you've just said this quest of safety rather than adventure.
But then hopefully at some point we see that our safe road has been repetitious or boring or dry, and we feel the pull toward external adventure. It's essential to feel that pull. There's something magnificent in feeling that human life is a quest that has to be sought after. If you either have been subdued into denying your adventure, or you never had an idea of one in the first place, then it may be the time that you rediscover and pursue some adventure that calls out to you. It is not possible that you could become an adventurer into the world of consciousness if you don't first begin in the world of ordinary possibilities.
My guest is J.J. Gold. He was just reading from his book, Just in Time, Autobiographical Stories from an American Spiritual Master. And when you were saying the road can become repetitious, boring, or dry, and I flashed back to when we were moving out of it. We'd lived in Bloomington, Indiana for 6 years, and we went to the bank to close out our account. And I realized that's the same teller when we opened an account here 6 years ago. She's still in that same chair. She's still doing the same thing. And meanwhile, we had lived in other places in the world and had adventures. So my life has never been repetition or boring or dry, but I'm so glad I didn't pass up opportunities for it to be even more exciting.
Well said.
And sometimes when people have a job and they're secure and they're safe, I admire somebody who leaves that behind and jumps, makes a change that they don't know where they're going or how it's going to turn out. But I really admire their courage to quit a job that they might not be happy in. And it looks like from all your various experiences, you've never been bored or doing anything repetitious.
Well, for moments, certainly everyone has experienced boredom. But what I call low content or quiet or times of reflection are also part of the story. So even though those are difficult to write about because there are no events to verbalize, that I wouldn't want to misrepresent my life in terms of that it was one adventure or one external thing after another. I have a very considerable value for contemplative time, for time for reflection, for being able to see different perspectives because of having enough time and space to take the time to do that. So that has been part of my life for quite some time as well.
Well, this brings up the subject of how you happened to be studying in Peru. And I'd like you to tell us, how did that come about?
Well, when I was quite young, I met a man who took a liking to me, and he invited me to come down to visit him. He lived on the shores of Lake Titicaca, which is on the border of Peru and Bolivia, and he lived in a small village there. He invited me to come to visit him anytime I wanted. I didn't take up that invitation for probably 6 or 7 years, but I think when I was about 11 or 12 was the first time I went down, and spent a month of the summer with him.
Here or summer there?
Summer there.
Okay.
I went down to his place in Peru, and I liked him. I liked his sense of humor. I liked all the things that he did. I had no idea whatsoever that he was a spiritual teacher, nor had any interest in that subject. In fact, if it was anything that I construed as religion-based, I would have gone in the opposite direction. But I did like him, and I liked his attitude, and we were friends from my perspective. And so every few years, I would go down there and visit for a time. And that probably when I was maybe 17 or so, I got the idea that there was something going on with him other than he was there to entertain me. And we developed our relationship, metamorphosized into something different and became very different. And he became my mentor, and turned out he was extraordinary.
Well, I am not your typical reader, I think, Justin, because I happen to have lived in Peru. So when you talk about chicha morada, I remember, they drank that, what seems like foul stuff there in Peru. Or you go to a town called Juliaca, which I remember the market there. And so the things that appeal to me would be different from somebody else. And so I think I'm an atypical reader of your book. But you talk about things and experiences that I think anybody can relate to what you describe in your book. You talk about the lessons you learned from poker, for example. And you also tell this interesting story about astronauts thinking, we've got to come up with a pen. We can write in zero gravity with this pen. So they spent millions developing this pen. Tell that story.
Well, that's something I heard. It's not a personal story.
No, right.
It was neither the astronaut nor the kid. But the astronaut's son, who was a child, maybe an 8 or 9 year old child, says, how come you went through all this process of developing a pen? How come you didn't use a pencil? And which wouldn't have required the zero gravity or anything like that. So I think that simplicity is an interesting story, interesting perspective.
I had heard that story before, but I still find it amusing that we're trying to make something complicated when a 6-year-old sees, this is really pretty simple, Dad. Mm-hmm. When you were going to Peru, you were really young yourself. I didn't remember that you were only like 11 the first time you went to Peru.
The first time I was 11 or 12, I don't remember which, but yes, that was the first time I went, and I went for entertainment and doing what any kid would want to do, and I was really a very ordinary kid and liked doing the things that New York City kids like to do. And going there sounded adventurous. It was an alternative to going to summer camp or going to my family's summer house. So I did it. It was more what so much activity is based on. It's avoiding, getting away, trying to find something desperately that's going to be satisfactory. And I had no idea that it would be that. It was just something different.
Well, this gentleman that you went to visit and you ended up studying with him, and he had a son named Oscar.
He had a nephew named Oscar.
Nephew.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And Oscar didn't exactly agree with the point of view of your teacher.
Oscar was older than I, and took it upon himself to be my oppressor, you might say, as 17-year-olds tend to do to 11-year-olds, or I don't remember how old he was. But he was certainly interesting and made an impression on me, and their dynamic was very interesting to me. And Oscar later became a world-known spiritual teacher, and which is certainly interesting. And there are so many people that I've crossed paths with that I've either disagreed with or agreed with. It hasn't been that relevant. But this mentor that I had in Peru and others that I've crossed paths with really inculcated in me the valuation for learning and how to learn and not to demand circumstances be overt or clear or that I be in agreement with. And I have really learned that and try to pass it on as maybe one of the most valuable things that I understand is there are subtleties happening in every situation, and I'm not exaggerating, but I say every situation where there is something beneath the surface of things, some subtlety, some hidden something that a person can learn from. And if we negate things and we disagree with things before we take a moment to appreciate them, that there is something, even though I disagree with this or I don't like this. So I've really learned that and was able to pursue the spiritual pursuit and proceed relatively on an express route, you might say, in that regard, because I did learn how to learn.
Well, this book, I think, will appeal to a variety of people because of your varied experiences as you growing up and the experiences you can draw on to illustrate the points that we can learn from life as situations come to us and present themselves.
Well, that's my hope. I don't really have a design for the story and for the book and that it's going to become a bestseller and that I can become famous. It's more that I would like to see it lodged in perpetuity, because I have gotten so much value from books, and books that have happened even hundreds of years ago. So I hope this becomes one of them.
Thank you, Justin. The book is Just in Time, Autobiographical Stories from an American Spiritual Master. Justin writes under the name J.J. Gold. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.